welcome to the show. I'm Abby Jorgensen.
I'm Jennifer Dudley, and this is Fascinating Ordinary, where we get curious about everyday things that are actually amazing.
We're really glad you're here with us today. Jennifer, which rabbit hole are we going down?
Today, Abby is trusting me with a really special topic, food and grief, or comfort food. This episode started out as the universality of food, but while starting my research, I realized that the most interesting universal aspect of food is how people use food to cope with grief. So today we're going to talk about popular ideas of comfort food, the science behind food and food rituals as comforting, and we'll finish with a few grief rituals from around the world.
So in case you haven't picked up on this yet, this episode is going to talk a lot about grief and loss and death. And we want to highlight that if that's not the thing that you and your soul needs right now, then feel free to skip on to our next episode because we'll be talking about something different. But we hope that if you're curious about this, you'll keep listening. Or if you are curious about this but now isn't the right time, you'll use your wisdom and your discernment and you'll listen to it at a better time for you.
So I'm going to start with some of the popular ideas about comfort food and grief eating rituals, particularly as tropes in popular media.
Okay.
So there is a website that I love called TVTropes.com. Have you heard of this?
Never.
Oh my gosh. I love it. I also love TV. So like anything TV adjacent is great. TVTropes.com catalogs all the instances of a particular trope in advertising, TV, movies, comic books, radio, like truly the list goes on.
Interesting.
Do you know what a trope is?
Yeah, like a thing that is a stereotype or a storyline that just repeats over and over, sometimes because it's true and sometimes because we've decided it's true.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So a trope could be something like star-crossed lovers, like that idea will show up over and over again. And obviously we know like one very famous example being Romeo and Juliet, but like there are lots of instances in movies and TVs where that relationship will show up over and over again. A different kind of trope might be something like in rom-coms, there will be a like beautiful female lead and her only flaw is that she's clumsy.
Mm-hmm.
So like the clumsy female lead or a manic pixie dream girl or things like that. So
like it is November right now and we are approaching Hallmark season of Christmas movies. And there have been a lot of memes on the internet in the last week about like just shout out to all of the well-dressed guys in business suits who are about to get dumped for a small town guy in flannel.
That's right.
So that's the trope, right?
Yes,
exactly. Okay. All right.
So the comfort food trope, like many other tropes, includes subtropes. So like subcategories of this overarching category. And there are things like characters having a trademark favorite food or like heartbreak and ice cream or drowning my sorrows or calming tea. Like these are all instances of popular media that involve like food being something like comforting or a source of comfort or something that people use to deal with grief or difficulty. So I want to share with you a few of my favorite comfort food tropes.
Okay.
And after I compiled this list, I realized that I am like a really basic B, as they say. Since we decided on a G or PG rating for this, I won't say the real thing.
Thank you.
But you'll see. So the first is ratatouille.
I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen it.
No.
I have decided to stop being surprised that Abby hasn't seen a movie.
It's about a rat who cooks, right?
That's right. Well, sort of. The rat uses somebody else to help make his cooking dreams come true. It stars Patton Oswalt as the titular ratatouille. It's amazing. The movie is great. It's not the best movie ever made, but like Patton is great. I love Patton Oswalt. It's a very cute movie, and there's a food critic in the movie named Anton Ego, and he's sort of, I know, right?
That's great.
Yeah. He's sort of like a villain in the movie, in that, you know, he decides the fate of, I called Patton Oswalt's character the titular character, Ratatouille, is not the name of the rat. Remy is the name of the rat.
Oh.
Shows what kind of fan I am.
Well, Ratatouille is the name of a famous dish. I assume yes. That was where this was going.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. Okay, good. Oh, man. Anyway.
I would have believed that that was the name of the rat, too. I did believe that that was the name of the rat.
Yeah. So, his name is Remy. But, so Remy makes Ratatouille the dish. The titular dish.
There we go.
And he is trying to show off his skills. He's trying to prove himself. This is towards the end of the movie. And he makes it for the food critic, Anton Ego. And when Anton eats the ratatouille, which, I don't know that it matters. But in case anyone is interested, I don't know, this might get cut.
Go for it.
Ratatouille is a dish.
An eggplant dish.
Yeah, it's a dish made out of vegetables. It's like, it might have roots deeper than just like French cuisine, but it's considered a peasant dish. It's eggplant and tomato and onion and like maybe squash and herbs and, you know, really like casserole style or like...
I was going to say, the Midwesterner in me is like, this is a casserole.
Yeah,
this is
exactly.
A casserole, and the French put a fancy name on it where they skipped pronouncing half the letters and now it's a fancy thing.
Well, so it's not supposed to be a fancy thing in France. It's really supposed to be peasant food.
I see.
But Remy makes like a fancy version where he sort of like, it's laid out like potatoes gratin. You know, like where all of the vegetables are like thinly sliced and like layered beautifully.
Okay.
And everyone's nervous in the movie because you're serving peasant food to the critic.
Ah,
like we're going to lose our, you know, status as a fancy restaurant. But Anton Ego, the critic, eats the fancy ratatouille and he cries tears of joy thinking of the happy memories of his mother,
mm-hmm.
like from when he ate, you know, like when his mother would prepare the dish,
mm-hmm.
and he has a complete change of heart about the restaurant and like they, you know, go on to great success, blah blah blah.
You should have put a spoiler warning on this for anyone who was gonna watch Ratatouille and didn't. I'm sorry that Jennifer just ran the movie.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's from, like, 2001.
So we haven't gotten around to it at this point.
Yeah,
going to.
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So he is really connected to the food because of the memory it brings to him.
Exactly.
Not particularly because of the food itself.
Well, yeah, and so the experience of eating the food brings comfort to this man. So another trope. Oh, my gosh. I'm sure I'll keep it together during this, but I am actually a little bit nervous about, like... becoming emotional while talking about this next example.
That's okay.
So this example comes from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which I have watched several times through.
Mm.
You know, the creator is problematic, but I'm of the school of thought that says if you love something that someone awful has created, but like this was a joint effort, several actors and like crew members and, you know, writers other than just... the original guy who created this participated in creating a show that is wonderful. And just because this one creator, like the guy who is responsible for Buffy the Vampire Slayer is considered kind of a lech, doesn't mean that I can't love the show. But, you know, I want people to know I'm not trying to sweep under the rug, like, what he's about.
I have absolutely no idea what you're referring to, but I can guess fairly well. So,
yeah.
Okay. All right. So with that in mind, though.
With that in mind, I love the show. I continue to love the show. So this, again, spoiler for if you haven't watched Buffy and you intend to, there is a point in the show where Buffy's mom dies. And it's like that episode happens, and then in the very next episode, all the characters are sort of sitting around waiting at the hospital morgue, and the friends, Buffy's friends, go to get something from the cafeteria and, like, return to Buffy with armloads of, like, soda and chips and chocolate and sandwiches, and, you know, they're presenting them to Buffy, and Willow, her friend, says, "We panicked." And this moment from the scene to me points to the power of the trope, that we don't need an explanation for we panicked. Willow doesn't say, we panicked and bought several food items, which we think you'll find comforting because food is often used to comfort people in times of grief, and you just lost your mother. All of that is implied to the audience, and we, the audience, get it. Like, we don't need the explanation.
Yeah.
Yeah, I managed to get through it without tearing up. But truly.
That's beautiful, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I have to skip this episode on rewatches now. Like, I've seen it, I've seen the episode a few times, but I'm at the point now where I'm like, no, I'm just going to skip this. I don't need to cry right now. It's very emotional. The last example comes from Gilmore Girls.
I have actually seen Gilmore Girls.
Yeah.
That being said, I have no idea what you're going to refer to right now.
Oh, so that's okay.
I don't remember Gilmore
Girls. Because there's a few grief episodes in Gilmore Girls. Yeah. But so I'm actually talking about an episode where Richard being the Gilmore grandpa, cooks his favorite meal for the like Friday dinner that the whole family does once a week. They usually eat very fancy meals. But he cooks Johnny Machete, which is like a casserole with a can of cream mushroom soup. And she says it's 12 different colors. And he says, oh, this is my favorite thing to eat as a boy. My gran used to make this for me whenever I was feeling a little sad. You know, if my cricket team lost or a girl I fancied turned up her nose at me. So, like, it's just... I don't know. It's very sweet. And I think, again, points to this idea that we know we can relate to Richard having this food that brings him back to times when he needed comfort and someone he loved gave him that comfort with food. And so one last example, this is actually from a book that I haven't read, but in looking through TVTrips.com, they presented this quote. It's from a book called Cinnamon and Gunpowder, and the author is Eli Brown. And I just thought it sort of summed up the way we as a society or the way popular media presents comfort food. So, Abby, I'm going to have you read that quote.
Yeah. Some foods are so comforting, so nourishing of body and soul, that to eat them is to be home again after a long journey. To eat such a meal is to remember that, though the world is full of knives and storms, the body is built for kindness. I love that.
Isn't
my
that so
goodness.
Nice? Yeah.
I gotta read this book now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, I think that the trope, I think the idea of food as comforting or something that we turn to in times of grief, that we share with people when we are feeling sad and we need to be cheered up, or when we don't need to be cheered up, but we just want to be remember the people who are important to us or times that are important to us. I think that's something that feels pretty universal, and it's something that we can relate to very easily.
And there's something about like the basic necessity that really matters here too. Like, one of the things that I will frequently tell bereavement doulas when I am doing trainings for them to support families through loss is, it is not your job to make anything better. It is just your job to make sure that people don't go through hell alone. And the idea of like going through hell in whatever situation that is, right? Whether you're missing somebody or you just lost somebody like Buffy did or something like that, the idea is that you still have to feed yourself, right? Like, nothing you say is going to make anything better at that moment, but you still have to eat. And that's just like one of the terrible things about grief, is that the world somehow still goes on and you still somehow have to feed yourself. So the idea that there is like chips out there and 12 color casserole, which I cannot remember the name of at all.
Johnny Machete.
There we go. Like, the idea that there is that just really resonates, I think, for a lot of us on a very human level.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And the next piece of this then, for me, was the science.
Like, why? Right.
Exactly.
Like, why is it? So there's like a necessity bit to this, which makes a lot of sense to me. Like, you have to eat. You have to eat at some point during grief, because grief is going to be with you for the rest of your life. Okay. Why is it, though, that like certain foods are things like, when I'm sad, I am immediately thinking of like mac and cheese, right? I'm immediately thinking of warm hot chocolate or apple cider. Like, what is the science of why we're drawn towards certain foods in moments of needing comfort?
Yeah. So I had those same questions. I wanted to know, like, is there something to this? Is this trope based on something real, or is this one of those things that TV invented and now we just have sort of accepted it as part of our lives? Like, my favorite article in my research has been Comfort Food, A Review by Charles Spencer.
Very aptly named.
Yes, exactly. Okay. All right, great. Because I think he covered, like, even in my looking through the research that was available, I think he did a really good job of covering these are the questions that people have asked, and this is what the science says.
Okay. From, like, a nutritional standpoint or, like, a psychology standpoint or what?
I will say sort of both, in that the research is coming from psychology publications, but also, like, appetite, like, health, nutrition. You know, there's, like a few different academic worlds that are concerned with this.
I believe that.
And, you know, I can't say what he left out. Well, I can't. I can speak to some of the things that he left out. But I didn't go on a deeper dive than him.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. He wrote an article about
it. Yes. He got published.
Bored, Jennifer. Yeah. Could you please? Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, this comes from 2017. He has a paragraph that I think does a good job summing up the state of research on the idea of comfort food or, you know, food for grief. Yeah. And I would love for you to read this quote.
Yeah. Intriguingly, while most people believe that comfort foods elevate their mood, robust empirical findings in support of such claims are somewhat harder to come by. Such results have led to some influential headlines suggesting that the very notion of comfort food is nothing more than a myth. While this might be overstating matters somewhat, it is clear that many uncertainties still surround if, when, and for whom the consumption of comfort food really does provide some sort of psychological benefit. Okay, I have questions.
I know, right? So
you seem a lot more chipper about your questions than
I am. That's because I know where this
is guy already. Okay, all right. Tell me.
Okay, yeah. So what he is getting at is that there is a lot of research that either comes to conflicting conclusions about the state of comfort food. There's no set definition about what food is comforting, but there absolutely is evidence that food provides some psychological benefit or, you know, some comfort.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that as much evidence as there is about, like, how food can be psychologically comforting, there's disagreement about what foods can be comforting. And so I think some of the reason for this, and we'll get into the specifics, is that science has been a little bit preoccupied about finding, like, the comfort foods, like naming these foods or these food types as comforting, as opposed to finding how food is comforting.
Yeah.
And so once that turn happened and once science started looking at, like, how food is comforting, it stopped mattering that one food or another might be comforting to one person, but not another.
Right.
And so one of the things that he's hinting at in that paragraph where he says, like, influential headlines suggesting the very notion of comfort food is nothing more than a myth.
Mm-hmm.
So he's actually hinting at a 2014 study called The Myth of Comfort Food.
Okay. All right.
It's
not really hinting.
Yeah. So this was a study that had 100 participants watch upsetting movies for 18 minutes.
Okay.
To induce a bad mood. Then the participants ate either their preferred comfort food, a neutral snack, a different equally liked food, or no food at all. And they found that mood improved equally in all four conditions. So that would suggest that comfort food is not more comforting than any other food or than no food. But Spencer points out, and other research points out, that watching an upsetting movie isn't really the same as experiencing a hardship or loss. So already it's like, I mean, I watched a movie.
Yeah.
Like, maybe it ruined my mood, but I'm not grieving.
Right.
And a 2015 study in particular suggested that watching a movie doesn't induce the kind of social isolation that comfort foods actually alleviate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to put that social isolation point on hold.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very important and we are going to get back to it.
Mm-hmm.
But before we do, I want to like continue on with some of the questions that Spencer had addressed that I think are important.
Mm-hmm.
So the first is, who is food comforting for? Like, do different people find different foods comforting? And to me, that sounded like a no-brainer. Like, what mm-hmm. I find comforting probably isn't the same as what you find comforting.
Right, like the Johnny Manchin, whatever, Johnny
Manchin.
Like, that's
Manchetti.
Only going to be comforting to Richard Gilmore
that's right.
compared to you
but,
or I.
Yeah, but I was hoping for answers to questions like, is the food I find comforting more similar to the food my grandmother finds comforting or to my husband?
Mm-hmm.
Like, does generation matter, gender, upbringing? I am kind of disappointed to say that several of the studies that I saw on this topic come from Brian Wansink. And do you know who this is?
No.
Okay. So there's like some previous reporting on Brian Wansink's research ethics and integrity that make me remiss to report specific findings from his specific papers. But in general, it seems like he sort of wrote the book on the idea that there are gender and age differences in preferences for types of comfort food. But he names, like, women like these foods, men like these foods. But because of his questionable, like, findings from some past studies, I'm not going to come out and say, like, oh, men like this and women like this, because I don't want people to take that away from me. I don't want to be giving him that platform.
I also don't buy that, just, like, off the bat. Like, there are so many different foods that are available in so many different parts of the world.
That's
how could possibly one thing that cuts through all that?
Exactly. Yeah. But there are two other studies, and Spencer points to these, that suggest that comfort foods are more likely to be beneficial when consuming the food brings back positive associations of early social interaction, like when a caregiver may have provided food to an individual when they were a sick child. Like Johnny Manchetti.
Mm-hmm.
So this at least suggests that, like, your childhood associations matter a lot for the food that you find comforting.
That makes sense.
I'm taking us right back to that topic of the social and that study about the social isolation that I had brought up earlier.
Mm-hmm.
There was one study that said comfort food didn't have any specific benefit for mood. They made people watch upsetting movies. Well, this 2015 study said that watching an upsetting movie wouldn't hit the kind of grief or wouldn't produce the kind of grief that comfort food alleviates. That study is called Threatened Belonging and Preference for Comfort Food Among the Securely Attached, and it was published in Appetite in 2015. So very quickly, the main takeaways here are comfort food is associated with relationships in that it has social utility.
Yeah.
The social utility of comfort food shapes preferences for it. Feeling isolated predicts how much people enjoy comfort food.
Mm-hmm.
And threatening belonging leads people with secure attachment styles to enjoy comfort food more. So the better your relationship to loved ones, especially when you were younger, the more you're going to be able to enjoy comfort foods that you enjoyed when you were forming those attachments.
And is the mechanism there just that there's more options to choose from? Like, the more securely attached you were growing up, the more people who loved you and took care of you, the more chances you had for someone to serve you mac and cheese or Johnny Spaghetti? I'm not going to remember
that's
this whole time. But is it, like, just an opportunity sort of a mechanism?
I don't think that they document that mechanism, though we'll talk a bit more about other studies and mechanisms. So I'm going to say at this point, I thought I was done with the sciencey part of my research, but while putting together the finishing touches on my notes, I came across more research by Michael Norton and Francesca Gino and their colleagues at the Harvard Business School of all places.
Yeah.
and they were working to prove the multiple benefits of using rituals.
Yes.
Do you know about this?
Yes.
What? Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. So I'm so excited to know that you have heard about this research. For our listeners who are not nearly as well read as you, I will say they are doing experiments to study grief rituals. To be clear, they're not talking exclusively about community or religious rituals. They are
food, right?
Or food. You're right. But they are generalizing to like private or idiosyncratic rituals. So, a community food ritual might be like eating pumpkin pie on Thanksgiving. A religious one might be saying a prayer before eating a meal. But as an example of a private or idiosyncratic food ritual, I will say before I sprinkle cinnamon on a coffee drink, I will say to myself, just a whisper of cinnamon, quoting an old Frasier episode.
Okay, nice. Yep.
And that ritual makes the experience more effective and or powerful mm-hmm. or enjoyable than just doing the thing without the ritual. So like my coffee is better because I have said just a whisper of cinnamon
yeah.
than if I had just poured the cinnamon on and moved about my day.
Yeah. When Eleanor started to talk, one of the first words that she learned was ravioli. But she cannot for the life of her actually say the word ravioli because mm-hmm. that's a lot of sounds to make with your mouth, ravioli. Mm-hmm. So she called it ooh.
Excellent.
There is something that still makes ravioli better even, you know, a year and a half, two years later, now that she can say ravioli if I say we're having ooh for dinner.
Yeah.
Like there's something so just like very base to my humanity that I love with that. Yes. So the idea that rituals and the people we create them with and the situations in which they're created and the things we're grieving when we repeat them, whether it's like the loss of the little girl who couldn't say ravioli, right? Just in terms of that she's grown up, or if it's something where it's a loss that's more permanent, right?
That's right.
That makes a lot of sense to me. But I'm not going to get into this because, once again, you are explaining to me what these Harvard people found.
Oh, yeah. Well, so Norton and Gino are talking about one of the mechanisms that makes ritual experiences more effective than the non-ritual version of the same experience is an increased sense of control, either of the situation or the grief. Mm-hmm. So one experiment they did, they induced grief from a feeling of loss. And if you remember that one study, like, we're going to make your mood bad by having you watch upsetting movies. Like, well, that's not good enough. I kind of love this. Like, we could poke holes in it, absolutely. But I'll just say I kind of love it. They can't randomly assign people to break up with their significant other or
that would
like
be unethical.
Yes.
Yes.
So they had to create instant grief from a feeling of loss.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they did that was they held a series of sessions in which about a dozen college age participants learn that one of them, picked at random, would get $200. No strings attached.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of money for an 18-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
In each session, the winner took the money and left the room. And just like that, the rest of the participants are left with a sudden feeling of loss. And there is other research that points to like being told that you have the possibility of money and then having that possibility taken away absolutely induces a real feeling of loss.
Yeah.
Like, that was mine, yeah. even though it was actually never yours.
Which is applicable to real life, too, right? Mm-hmm. There are many situations where if you're hoping for that job promotion or you're hoping for that baby or you're hoping for that proposal or whatever it is and it doesn't happen, that's something you grieve. And that is really real,
yeah.
even though it was a possibility and not the actual thing you lost. That's a really real grief.
Exactly. And so I really like the way they induced instant feelings of loss.
Mm-hmm. A lot more ethical than making people break up with their
Absolutely. Then they split the participants in two groups. And Abby, I'm going to have you describe the rituals they performed.
Okay. I am quoting from the article. Mm-hmm. I'm not quoting from my memory. So you should trust this a lot more. The ritual conditioning group performed a series of ritualistic tasks, including drawing a picture about their current state of mind, sprinkling salt on the drawing, tearing up the drawing, and silently counting to 10. The non-ritual conditioned participants only drew a picture. After the experiment, the ritual group reported feeling more in control and less bummed out about the $200 than the non-ritual group.
Yeah, so, like, an important takeaway here is that the people in the ritual group experienced the effect, that relief, like, not feeling so acutely this loss, whether or not they use rituals in any other part of their life. Mm-hmm. So these aren't people that are, like, already attuned to using rituals to make themselves feel better after mm-hmm. a loss. Tell me your thoughts about the ritual, the experiment. Would this have worked for you?
Yeah, oh, I absolutely think so. So because I come from this from a grief worker perspective, one thing that I think rituals really provide us in these scenarios is a social script. So what I mean by that, that's the sociologist, not the grief worker. But what I mean by that is that sometimes after a loss, whatever the loss is of, it is really hard to know what to do. So when someone tells you, okay, draw a picture of your current state of mind, then once you're done with that, they tell you, okay, put salt on the picture. Like, this gives you action items of things to do that provide the next step. And sometimes with grief, the hardest thing in the world is the next step, is just identifying it, right? Let alone actually getting up the courage to do it, finding the supplies to do it. So when you have some researcher handing you a sheet of paper and a pencil and being like, okay, this is what you're going to do next, that social script can save so much mental energy, can give you so I think there's a part of this that, like, no matter what the ritual is, someone else telling you to do something and making it possible for you to do something, even if that's just, like, your memory, right? Like, mm-hmm. you always grew up, you always know that at a funeral we go up and we say, I'm so sorry for your loss to the person. If that's what you did growing up and then that's what you do, you don't need someone in your lab coat running an experiment to be like, okay, the next thing you're going to do is this thing, right? But whoever has told you that or taught you that, if you know what to do next, grief is not easier, but there is a way forward in it and with it and through it. And so that idea of a social script provided through a ritual, I don't think you need a social script to be something you've known for decades. I think it can be something someone hands you in the moment, like this researcher did, mm-hmm. right? And as a bereavement doula, that's one of the things that I do, is I hand families rituals of, like, here are things you can do. Here's what you could take as your next step if you wanted to. And I think that's really valuable, because being creative when you're in grief is one of the hardest things in the world, right? Coming up with this yourself is one of the hardest things in the world. Coming up with your next step is one of the hardest things in the world. So social scripts and rituals give you that next step, even if you've never taken that step before. Mm-hmm. And I think when it is something you've taken before, like having that meal that your loved one made for you when you were sad, then there's, like, an extra element of love and of healing and of peace that comes with it. But I don't think you even need that in order to have a beautiful ritual for grief.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I love how you point to the power of rituals for grief in as a social script. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the reasons that grief rituals and grief food rituals in particular are something that are so universal.
Yeah.
Every culture has some, well, I can't say every culture has some grief food ritual. Every culture has grief rituals.
Yeah.
But
side note, that's how sociology became a field,
is
was
grief
the study of funerals.
Yeah.
That's, like, how we all started. That's why Jennifer and I have our jobs.
That's right. Yeah, that's probably why this episode feels so important, too.
To both,
like,
of us. Yeah.
Yeah.
But this isn't just specific to sociologists, too, right? Like, it's not just sociologists who relate to something with funerals. And it's not just grief workers who know something about ritual. And, like, I'm sure everybody listening can think of some moment that we've had, whatever it was, when there was a social script that was handed to us and we really needed that, or there was a social script that was apparent and it gave us a way to move forward. So this seems like something that's really, really universal, right?
Absolutely.
Did you come across this in your research?
I really did. And in fact, with the universality of grief rituals, mm-hmm. and in particular, the commonality of grief food rituals. Mm-hmm. I can't say that there are grief food rituals in every society, mm-hmm. because I haven't surveyed them. Mm-hmm. But I can say that grief food rituals are very common throughout the world and throughout the time. Mm-hmm.
Throughout time.
So much so that I actually struggled with how to structure this next section. Mm. I thought, should I go chronologically and start with stories of like ancient Egyptian pharaohs being entombed with food to sustain them in the afterlife? Should I do this as like a geographic overview, highlighting a few rituals from each continent? At one point, I seriously considered presenting these in order of difficulty. Like, bringing bread and wine to a grave is pretty simple, but like multi-day feasts are quite difficult.
Yeah, okay.
In the end, I settled on grouping rituals into two categories. The first is food rituals that are meant to support the dead in the afterlife.
Okay, yeah.
And the second is food rituals that are meant to support those who are mourning the dead. And so both of these are really important ways to honor community and loved ones. But I think the question of who we center and why in the ritual is really an interesting one. I will say this is not meant to be a comparison in order to say one is better or worse, but rather that these are both ways that people have found to bring beauty to their grief.
Yeah. And to have a step forward, whatever that step is, right? And so it seems like these are different tools that one would use for different purposes.
Exactly.
And so we're going through all of them. Yeah. That makes sense.
Exactly. So starting with food rituals that support the deceased. Some societies continue to feed the people they have lost for up to a year, while others offer food every year on special holidays or anniversaries. Sometimes food is placed on, like, on a grave or next to a grave, or some societies will pour alcohol on top of the grave, like ancient Greece, I guess, you know, burial rites in ancient Greece, I guess, involved that. As I had said earlier, food was buried with pharaohs. In ancient Rome, there is a system developed where tubes are attached to the top of graves and lowered into the deceased's mouth so that mourners can supply them with bread and wine. In the Mayan civilization, the dead were buried with maize in their mouth so that they would have that. The more interesting rituals, in my opinion, oh gosh, not to say that those are uninteresting. The ones that captured my attention are the ones that involve the people mourning the deceased engaging with their ancestors through the food ritual, as opposed to like the other more passive rituals, like leaving a food offering. So there's a Korean eating ritual for dead ancestors. This is from the book Dying to Eat, Cross-Cultural Perspectives on Food, Death, and the Afterlife. And the chapter is by Young-un Sophia Park. The chapter is called The Eating Ritual in Korean Religiosity, Young Sanjae for the Dead and for the Living. So, so you know, South Korea is about 20% Buddhist, 30% Christian, and 50% non-religious. And there seems to be a lot of overlap in their modern rituals where they have like borrowed or taken or adapted from their various religious traditions. The author offers this quote. It is often said Koreans have a shamanic gut, a Buddhist heart, a Confucian head, and a Christian body. And so one of the common elements is eating rituals for ancestors, like across these religious traditions. Eating is a way to connect or reconnect with dead ancestors. And this is like a core element of Korean religiosity. Every household practices some ritual of ancestor veneration where the act of preparing or eating food for the dead is a part of the ritual. They have Christian rites in which the primary eating ritual centers around the Eucharist, which is a crucial part of the Mass in the Catholic tradition. The Eucharist specifically recalls the death of Jesus and his resurrection. This ritual reenacts Jesus' final dinner with his disciples, and in the moment of eating bread and drinking wine, the past and future become one in the present, and Korean Catholics in particular celebrate Mass in remembrance of the souls for their family, which I think is like a really powerful adaptation of taking this. I mean, as an American, like having been raised in an American Catholic family, we saw the weekly Mass as a religious duty, but not as a way to celebrate our particular family. And so that like bringing together of the Korean tradition of ancestor veneration with the Catholic ritual of the Eucharist, I thought was just like a really interesting way to blend those.
Yeah. The Catholic teaching on this really highlights when heaven and earth meet at the Eucharist. And so highlighting ancestors, highlighting the dead, that's something that I've seen happen a lot in U.S. society in my work, mostly in like families feeling most connected to their little ones who have passed away because of the Eucharist. But that the like very intentional like attention to the Eucharist as that moment is something that seems to be more of a thing in Korea, from what you're saying, in South Korea than in the U.S.
Well, that then in my experience in the U.S.,
yeah.
I'll say. I'm not a representative.
You won't speak about Catholicism in broad terms then.
So moving on to a Buddhist ritual, Yung Sanjae. In Korea, this is one of the most significant eating rituals for the dead, and it's performed on June 6th, Korea's Memorial Day, and it symbolically reenacts the last festival that the historical Buddha had with his disciples. Yung Sanjae is like this solemn eating ritual for the dead and for the benefit of the souls of the dead. So Abby, I have a quote for you here.
Ritual creates a liminal space where the boundary between the living and the dead, and the secular and the sacred, is blurred. In the food rituals for the dead, Koreans experience reunion with ancestors, and food functions as the medium. The food symbolizes the life-giving love of God and that of ancestor, while it represents the descendants' respect and piety. Here, food demonstrates the communal nature of the ritual.
Yeah, so I really appreciate that in both the Christian Eucharist ritual and in the Buddhist Yung Sanjae ritual, there's a coming together of the secular and the sacred, you know, the living and the dead, the past and the future, the heaven and the earth, and that food is the, like, junction where this happens.
And that, like, in both of these situations, it's the leader having their last meal with the people that surround them that is the impetus for the occasion, right? Like, the Last Supper in the Christian church, the last festival the Buddha had with his followers, like, all that. It's inherent to grief, right? Like, both of these are losses. And reenacting that loss or remembering that loss or re-entering into that loss, depending on your theology, involves food again. Like, that's just a universal thing across time and space.
The stated purpose of the food rituals that we just talked about is for communities to honor or support the deceased. Now I'm going to share some food rituals where the stated purpose is to support the living. And even within them, there is still some overlap because the grief food rituals, even the ones intended to support the people who are mourning the dead, there is always a remembrance or a, you know, being in communion with the people that you have lost.
Well, because loss and grief are inherently relational.
Yes.
Right? Like, you can't take that apart.
So yes. Makes sense. Yeah. So one version of this that a lot of our listeners may have heard about is sitting Shiva. This is the act of Jewish mourners participating in the traditional rituals of observing a Shiva. So for 7 days after the loss of a loved one, family members gather in one location. It's usually the home of the family that has lost somebody. And this includes a really extensive ritual with a lot of components, including meals. And there's a website, shiva.org, that has a lot of excellent guides for people planning a Shiva or who want to visit the home of someone who's observing the ritual. But I just wanted to give that as an example that I think, you know, in the United States might be, like, I assume our listeners are going to be in the United States and might have heard of that one since it's, maybe I'm just thinking of my own experience that this is something that I know of. So that's one example. But another one that I want to highlight and spend a little more time on comes from South Africa. So from that same book, Dying to Eat, there is another chapter called Eating and Drinking with the Dead in South Africa from Roddy Kobo and Chimene.
And we'll link to all this in the show notes for anyone who is eager to look these up. What did this chapter highlight?
So focusing on the Swana and Zulu people, And Chimene is talking about how they venerate their dead ancestors, and during their lives, the living are in constant communication with ancestral spirits. But when a family loses somebody, eating and drinking happens in several stages after the death. And the stages are divided into four periods: pre-funeral, funeral, post-funeral, and post-post-funeral.
Okay.
So one of the things that I love about this, and I will talk about the different phases, but I love, you know, we had talked about having a social script. Mm-hmm. This is a very detailed social script with multiple different phases, four different groups of people. Mm-hmm. So there's pieces of this that apply to the family, you know, the sort of like the people closest to the deceased, and there's a script for people who have never met the deceased.
Yeah.
So starting with the pre-funeral, during the pre-funeral phase, friends, relatives, and neighbors come to visit the bereaved family and comfort them. The family serves tea or coffee and home-baked scones to anyone who comes.
Okay.
And, you know, it's that part of it is fairly straightforward. And then we can move on to the funeral phase, wherein more people join. And this isn't reserved for just people who knew the deceased, but really anyone from the community can join. And Inchemene says that because of poverty levels, especially for Black South Africans, people might come just for the chance to receive a balanced meal. Mm-hmm. That essentially, depending on how the pre-funeral phase went, mm-hmm. like how, I wanted to say how generous they were, but that's not the right word. Depending on how much food the family had to offer, mm-hmm. or how extensive that tea and, you know, baked goods portion of the grieving was, mm-hmm. word will get around to the community. Like, this family has a lot to offer. Mm-hmm. So if you need, you should come. Mm-hmm. And so people who have never met them are absolutely welcome to come to their home and mm-hmm. like take part in their generosity.
Yeah. I love the idea that on the occasion of my death, my family would use that as an opportunity to use whatever financial resources we had to give food to whoever needed it. That's really beautiful.
Absolutely. Yeah. So to me, this highlights like the generous spirit of the community, like to say that this grief ritual is a time for members of the community to serve each other, mm-hmm. not just the family, not just the deceased, mm-hmm. but everybody, because the loss of a member of the community, it does affect everybody. Mm-hmm. So people who don't know the bereaved might come to get a meal, but at the same time, they are showing up to show their support for the family.
Yeah.
After the funeral phase is the post-funeral, and this is social feasting. And some religious leaders have criticized the post-funeral feast as excessive, mm-hmm. and it's actually pretty new, a newer part of the grief ritual that started with the emergence of a middle class in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And so the people participating in the post-funeral feast are mostly young people. They change their clothes from mourning clothes to party clothes. Mm-hmm. And it's referred to the after tears because we have finished shedding our tears. Mm-hmm. The body is interred. And now we're free to feast in honor of the departed mm-hmm. person that we loved. And so this becomes like I want to say the celebration part, but yeah. feast is really like the social feasting is a better way to put it. And then the last aspect of this, or the last phase of this mourning ritual is the post-post-funeral. And that phase includes a smaller meal called 10 days that occurs 10 days after the burial. And it takes place in the home of the deceased. And this piece of it really does involve like loved ones, mm-hmm. like family members, a smaller section of the community, mm-hmm. but that this lasts, that there's this expectation that like your grief isn't over just mm-hmm. because the burial happened.
Yeah.
I think is really nice.
That's beautiful.
So this ritual and the Korean rituals that I had described both see the living as in constant communion with death and the people they've lost mm-hmm. through veneration of dead ancestors. The relationship of the living to the departed doesn't end just because the funeral ended. And I can't help but contrast this with my own experience. I don't know if it's because I grew up in the 90s in a, like, California Catholic household, but like a lot of people I knew, I came into contact with death when a loved one passed. Unlike a lot of people I knew, I spent a lot of time with my grandmother, so I went to, a lot of funerals. I hung out with a lot of people who were over the age of 60, and they would pass, you know? And so I weirdly went to a lot of funerals as a young person. And the occasions were really somber and really intense. And when they were over, it felt like we had said goodbye to that person. And that's because we had. They weren't a part of our lives anymore. Like, we didn't talk about them. We didn't, like, I mean, I might have thought about them, but I didn't think that I could bring up those thoughts or those feelings with other people. It was like, no, they're gone. So they're gone from our lives. I don't think that restructuring my relationship to death in a manner that's more similar to the Zulu or the Swana or the Korean cultures would make death easier. Because I don't think it's easy for them. But I sort of imagine it must be nice to keep up frequent reminders of the people that you love who aren't with you anymore. And I really love the role that food plays in that ritual.
This is really interesting because we had a lot of similar experiences with very different sorts of perspectives. I went to a lot of funerals growing up because I was homeschooled. And I don't even know if I've told you this before, but this is like, I tried to count once, and it's a lot of funerals that I went to growing up because we had a very flexible schedule. And my mom's thing was, we don't let people grieve alone. So we'd go to all these funerals at my church, sometimes at other churches, people in the neighborhood, things like that. And it was really interesting seeing the diversity of types of funerals. There was one for a neighbor where everyone had to wear a Hawaiian shirt. And I just went, like, I had, since we went to so many funerals, I had, like, the outfit that I wore for funerals, right? Like, the dark and not too flashy. And then to go from that to, like, a Hawaiian shirt, I was, and it fit the guy perfectly, right? Like, it was a beautiful sort of honor to pay to him. But it was so funny. So I had my funeral planned before I ever had my wedding planned. Because I knew I was going to die, but I didn't know if I was going to get married or not, right? And I'd seen so many of these funerals, so many of these different options of, like, how you could celebrate someone's life. But the really funny thing about this, given what we're talking about today, is that my mom always took us home before the meal.
Oh, so you didn't get to experience it?
Never.
Wow.
Never. Like, the Eucharist, because a lot of them were Catholic funerals. So that was pretty consistent. But we always went home, and I don't know why. And I didn't think of that until right now. So I feel like I should call my mom and be like, why did you? To be fair, she had a lot of small children who were probably approaching nap time very quickly whenever we finally got to the eating portion of the day's worth of events, right, for a funeral. And it might have also just been, like, we didn't know most of these people. So showing up and eating dinner with them might have been more awkward. But showing up and making sure that there was somebody else in the church was a lot less awkward, right? Like, there was someone there for them, and there was somebody who honored their grief and their experience. But now I wonder what my experience would have been like if I had been at all of these dinners too. Probably, honestly, we would have had to go home because someone would have been crying. So I don't fault my mom for this at all, but now I do want to call her and ask her. She's listening. So, Mama, text me and tell me.
Text her.
Why we didn't ever go to the meals afterwards. But, like, I knew if, like, the person that had died was someone we really knew personally, because I knew whether we were going to the lunch afterwards.
Yeah.
But that experience, I think, that we've had of going to a lot of funerals is not the norm in U.S. society at all. Like, in college, I was at Notre Dame when Father Hesburgh died. And Father Hesburgh was a really big deal in a lot of different movements. One of the things he did was he made Notre Dame co-ed. So that worked out well for me. But he, I got to meet him once. I got to, he like has a ton of honorary degrees. He was the first civilian to break the sound barrier, I think. Like, all sorts of really amazing stuff all over Notre Dame and South Bend. There's images of him with Martin Luther King Jr. because he was a big white proponent of civil rights and a big ally in some ways. And the idea of, like, him dying, it just meant this huge, huge funeral, huge, like, days and days of dinners. The dining hall was doing stuff. Like, I was thinking about this a lot. But my dorm had the chance to go visit his body. And as we're in line, all of these people in my dorm are like, I've never seen a dead body before. I've never gone to a funeral before. Like, what do we do at a visitation? And I was like, what have you been doing with your lives?
Yeah.
Like,
How have you not had to experience it? Yeah. Right?
Yeah. So that was really startling to me. And I think that experience that you and I have had may not be the norm of, like, being used to a lot of funerals, being used to a lot of grief, being around that a lot, willingly putting ourselves in situations where we think about that and interact with that, whatever that may be, right? Like, who chose this podcast episode? Mm-hmm. So the idea of comfort with that has almost made me desensitized to what role food played in it.
Mm.
Like, I think I knew how important food was, and I talked to people all the time about how important food is, but I didn't really reflect on what that was like for me growing up. And now realizing, like, man, those were all of those funeral lunches that
we didn't have.
Yeah.
I have been to enough funeral lunches that and why I point again to, like, the idea of the California Catholic, because I think that there are aspects of my experience that are very particular to the place that I grew up.
Mm.
At all of those lunches, there was this particular wrap that you can get at Costco.
Oh.
That I suspect a lot of these funerals were, you know, quote unquote, catered by Costco.
Yeah, makes sense.
But, you know, I think it's a turkey deli meat and some sort of greenery and I think like a Swiss cheese or some white cheese and I think it's strawberry cream cheese on the inside.
Interesting. And I didn't see that for coming.
Yeah. So I developed a taste for these rolls at funerals.
Right. Yeah.
They are the place. If I have had them 20 times in my life,
yeah.
15 of those times have been at funerals.
That makes sense.
So that I thought that they are a funeral food.
That's what people do for funerals, right? They order the Costco strawberry cream cheese.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I went looking, you know, when I went looking online for examples of funeral foods or like really common foods, I was shocked to not see them there.
Right. That makes sense.
Because I thought this was a super common thing.
Yeah.
But no, it turns out it was just a my community thing.
Right. Yeah. Mine was marshmallow salad.
Oh, all right.
I don't know if you've been in the Midwest long enough for you to.
I didn't see that one there either. Salad.
No, I'm sure that's a Midwestern thing. And that's not just a funeral thing. That's also like a potluck thing and whatnot. But I do think that, like, there are definitely those foods that we would associate with funerals that
maybe others
on a cultural level wouldn't really work out. And one really cool thing about comfort food more broadly is that while we can think of a lot of examples from funerals, I can also think of a lot of examples from things that aren't the death of someone, right? Like, and we've highlighted this a couple of times in here, that it can be something like the loss of the potential of $200, right?
Yeah.
It can be the loss of a boyfriend, or it can be the loss of whatever, right? Whatever that situation is, whatever that grief is, a test not going well. Oh gosh, I can't tell you the number of times I got a Rutgers pizza because Rutgers is gone now. I'm too old at Notre Dame. But I got a Rutgers pizza because the test didn't go well or something like that. Like, the idea of food bringing us comfort really applies in these moments of grief, because that's when I think we most need that social script and grief and the loss of a loved one in particular. But then we see that in things like grief over a test not going well, or the loss of a potential couple $100 or things like that.
That's right.
So go-to foods, that's what I want to know. If you have a go-to food that you love to enjoy, I think drink should count too, because I really stand by my apple cider comment earlier. If you have a drink or a food that you tend to use and incorporate into your skill set, your tools, when you're experiencing some kind of a loss or some kind of grief, please share that with us. If it's the strawberry cream cheese turkey wrap that Jennifer had, she'll be eager to hear if someone else experiences that too. But I am really eager to know what other people experience as their comfort foods in times of grief, whatever kind of grief that is. And we'd love to share that with you and hold space for that with you, whatever it looks like. So you can reach out to us on Instagram at Fascinating Ordinary, on Facebook, Fascinating Ordinary, the page. If you want to help us buy all these foods so we can try them, you can fund those habits by supporting us on Patreon.
And thank you so much for listening. If you want to support the podcast and help us buy, I was going to say funeral food, but no, that's not right.
Do that one over.
If you want to support us, you can do so on Patreon.
Try that one more time.
No, you do it. I saw myself stumbling over that. I was just like,
it's okay.
I don't know what I'm doing. All right.